My name is Judy Madison. I'm a pastor in Minneapolis. I got interested in Dorothy Day, who we will be talking about today, when I was at seminary and did a lot of reading. I think I probably read everything at that point written about her or by her. And as I thought about Dorothy Day and Holden, I thought it would be a very appropriate thing to share some information about her, and maybe there'll be some discussion that will emerge from that. Let's use Matthew 25, it's so familiar, as our background. And then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink?" This is not Revised Standard Version. It is. Thank you. Did you know the Revised Standard Version still had these in it?
Good news.
And when did we see thee a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my friends, you did it to me." Let us pray. Give us, Lord, the vision that rested in the heart of Dorothy Day and is possible for all of us. In this place where we can see ahead and beyond, let us grab hold of what you offer us so that we may be servants in this world that you have given us. Amen. Let me share a couple of things that I've written. This in a book called Help Me Adapt, Lord. The subtitle, Discovering New Blessings While Learning to Live with Less. I just came from the store. You'd never know.
I just bought it. Yeah,
she just bought it. I really don't know much of sacrifice. We hear the word a lot, especially during Lent. But we've seldom had to get beyond the word to see the experience. I'm beginning to see I'll have to sacrifice more, if not for my children, then for my nation. God has told me about sacrifice through the scriptures. From Abraham and Isaac to Jesus and Stephen and Paul, we learn that God expects sacrifice. Like athletes who train, we develop ourselves, our will to do good, our trust of God's purposes, our ability to give. Sacrifice changes me from a rebellious, self-serving creature to a faithful, dedicated servant. Sacrifice brings me closer to God. We will discover that that is very true with Dorothy Day. When I feel poor, I open a book and look at pictures of the rest of the world, the children of Calcutta, the women of Ethiopia, the men of Mexico. Poverty is relative, and I am not one of the world's poor. If I spend my time thinking about the upper crust and envying them, I forget that a crust of bread would sustain a person a few hours longer if I would share it. As near as Detroit and Appalachia is the rope of poverty which strangles hope and determination. Look again at the pictures. I am not poor. And from a book called Life is Good, Life is Hard. This is a true story of a young boy who lived not too far from Minneapolis, I believe, in a family where everyone was out of touch with reality. No one in the family was sane, not one. Each saw life and people in distortion, except one. The middle son, surrounded by delusion and confusion, somehow learned that he was loved and how to interact with others. The doctors were perplexed. How? Who kept his mind and life bearable, consistent? One woman. She gave him milk and cookies many days when he stopped by as he walked home from school. One consistent, loving person. One. That's something of a miracle, I think. that one person actually did keep that little boy sane. He understood what life was really supposed to be because of her milk and cookies. Dorothy Day represents that kind of person to me. She was born in 1897, died just in 1980, so she lived a nice long life. And she was born and lived in Chicago. She was the daughter of a newspaper man, very much then aware of the world and what was going on. When she was young, she became kind of the babysitter for a much younger child in the family. And so she would take this child out in the stroller, and they'd walk all over the west side of Chicago. And she saw, in those places, that not everybody lived as she did. She was raised in a family of faith, but it was not important in her family, the church, that is. It was not central. And she also lived next door to some people who were Methodists, and she thought, gee, they had such a nice, peaceful way about them. She sort of envied them. But she could not put together this kind of conflict between what she saw in terms of poverty and homelessness and people working so terribly hard and oppressed, and the church, which appeared to her to be much more concerned with the afterlife in those days. And she literally railed against that as she got older and pulled away from her church background altogether. She said she just couldn't join the Epworth League like everyone else did, and particularly her college friends. And she went to college, and she had really kind of a, for a young woman of those, that time, we're talking now early 1900s, you know, about the First World War time. For a young woman, she was very ambitious and active, and herself a newspaper woman, very in touch with the rest of the world. She said, both Dostoevsky and Tolstoy made me cling to a faith in God. And yet I could not endure feeling an alien in it. I felt that my faith had nothing in common with that of Christians around me. She just sensed there was something different about the way she saw faith. And I will from many times now be quoting from various writings that she did. One of the things she said was that the Christians in Russia say, do not try to save us from the Bolsheviks. Now, this is the time of the Russian Revolution, of course. Don't try to save us from the Bolsheviks. They are materialistic with material aims, ignoring and denying God, and they say so. But Western Christians are also materialists with material aims, ignoring and denying God, but they don't say so. Leave us alone and perhaps a new Christianity will arise in Russia. She heard them, she listened. There are nowhere, she said, sufficient housing facilities right now, and I'm writing in 1917. When I think of the human suffering, the terrible amount of energy needed to move even an infinitesimally small way toward a decent life, I am amazed at human patience. Each of the radical groups had its own vision, and each was terrified that immediate gains would make the masses content and not willing to go further with this new earth that they were envisioning. Socialism, she said, was too doctrinaire. I could not understand Marx, she says, and the IWW had an immediate program for America, so I signed up with them. The International Workers of the World, right? Is that right? International Workers of the World. Wouldn't you think international and world is repetitious, but I think that's right. I should know better. Someone said that it stood for I won't work. I repeat some of those things so it goes on the tape. She said in her first newspaper job there was no attack on religion because everybody basically was tepid, lukewarm. Nobody really cared about religion. It just sort of existed. I have recently read Main Street. Have you ever read Main Street by Sinclair Lewis? And it's sort of the same period of time. It's very interesting how these conflicts emerge. You know, we tend to think of politics and religion as being so different. But the word politics comes from that poly is one of its sources, and that has to do with people. It has to do with the people. Politics means the way people gather together and organize themselves. And what's more people-centered than religion? These things will inevitably meet, whether we like that or not. You don't separate them. They're part of life. And Luther would say, get involved then. If it's there, use it. You know, use it for good. She describes the IWWs as looking on religion as the opiate of the people. You've heard that before. That's Marxist kind of stuff. Who thought they only had this one life to live and then oblivion. And she said, they were the ones who were eager to sacrifice themselves now and for all eternity. They were fighting to obtain for their brothers and sisters. God love them, she said. She understood that they had some energy that she saw missing, and she didn't she just couldn't identify with the Christian church in those days. And so she continued in her career. She had many friends. She lived a kind of happy-go-lucky life in some fashion. She drank a lot, you know, with her friends at night after they'd been working late. It was kind of a real adventuresome life. She did find that she always kind of ended up back in the church one way or another. Even sometimes after a late night with her friends, she would wander into some cathedral, maybe St. Patrick's in downtown Manhattan, because she worked in New York, and worship a bit. So she never quite could let it go, and you know, there are some of us like that. We would love to get away from God, and it never works, because God finds us all the time. And so it was with Dorothy. And she met a man, and she loved him, and had a child, his child, but did not marry him. And I think they lived together for about 3 years or more, and it was, for her, a very good relationship. But she was concerned about this child, that she wanted the child baptized. And he was not a believer. And this presented for her a tremendous internal conflict, and ultimately she left the common law relationship and had her child baptized, and then never was in relationship again with any man. So Dorothy raised her child alone. Now we have a single mother in the 20s. It in itself also an unusual and difficult position to be in. One time, Dorothy went to Washington, D.C., when they were having big rallies at that time for the workers. And this was, of course, a time when the workers were beginning to organize. And I'd like to read some pieces that she wrote at that time, one of them leading to a very important decision. I watched that ragged horde and thought to myself, these are Christ's poor. He was one of them. He was a man like other men, and he chose his friends amongst ordinary workers. These men feel they have been betrayed by Christianity. People are not Christian today. If they were, this sight would not be possible. Far dearer in the sight of God, perhaps, are those hungry, ragged ones than all those well-fed Christians who sit in their homes cowering in fear of the communist menace. Doesn't she sound like she's in her 20s? Late 20s, maybe. I identify with that kind of energy and spirit that she had. With them in the past, and now I was a Catholic, and so I could not be a communist. I could not join this united front of protest, and I wanted to. The Feast of the Immaculate Conception was the next day, and I went to the National Shrine and assisted at high solemn mass there. And the prayer that I offered up was that some way would be shown me, some way would be opened up for me to work for the poor and the oppressed. When I got back to New York, Peter Morin was at the house waiting for me. Peter turned out to be a very, very significant person in her life, and his He was a first-class idealist. I'll read a poem about him. Peter Morin believed in a green revolution, not red, when all would live and be productive on the land. To give and not to take, this is what makes man human, he said. A social doctrine of the common good, utopian Christian communism. Private property with responsibility. Hoe in hand between rows of beans, he lectured friends on his communitarian farms, on charity, unemployment, decentralization. One must give up one's life to save it, he said. Voluntary poverty, starting poor. A man with a dream. He needed a realist and someone to write his dream. He found Dorothy. And that was such a good combination. She was the realist. And he clearly the idealist. He just thought everybody ought to get back to the land, period, and have a small piece and share with one another, and those who didn't have enough, then the others would help provide for them, or who might be unable to do that, the work or whatever. It was a wonderful dream, but he needed somebody to put teeth into it and make some of it work. And he and Dorothy hit it off very well. And they started a paper called The Catholic Worker. To this day it exists. This one, I have, this is an old one, May 1984. This is the Minneapolis Catholic Worker. Up here in the corner is the emblem. And you, if I'll circulate it. It has the cross with Christ on the cross. And then it has a woman, and I believe it's a loaf of bread under her arm, and a worker with a pick over his shoulder, and he's black. Now you think about what that symbolized at the time, the equality of the male and female, the black and the white, the worker and the one at home, and all of this united under the in the cross of Christ was remarkable. And when I was reading through this, this particular piece is about women's issues, and particularly about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and what that means in today's world. And one of the articles is called, "Why Are You Women, or Men, So Upset About Pornography?" So it was dealing with a key issue of the time, and that's the kind of thing that the Catholic Worker has always done. And when they started out, they practically gave it away. The first time they gave away, they had 2,500 copies that they made out, put out, and they went out and just handed them out in, that place in New York. Greenwich Village. And on the corners to all the workers. There was a lot of activity going on in those days. Handed it all out. Then, of course, later, they were publishing 100,000 copies all the time, every week. Maybe we can start this around. That'd be great. So that's what Dorothy did. She's raising her child. She had this strange place where she lived in right in the heart of Manhattan, and in the back of it they put out this paper and circulated it and tried to talk to people about Christ and how Christianity was important in this world of in caring for people. So they had their own, quote, political, unquote, philosophy. One of the things that Dorothy believed that causes eyebrows to raise sometimes, and that she clung to this to the moment she died, she didn't believe in usury. She didn't believe anybody should charge interest, because she said, time belongs to God. And you don't charge anybody for time. Even if you've given them money, you don't charge them for time. She never changed from that point of view. I'll tell you more about that. Peter, on the other hand, said that he thought that the first unit of society was the family, and that's not unfamiliar to us, but that every home should have a Christ room in it. And this would be a place where hospitality would be practiced, so that everyone would always be welcoming someone into your home, a stranger, certainly. And that's very biblical. That's Old Testament, New Testament, everything. Welcome the stranger into your home, provide food. In fact, in the Old Testament, they provided such for long periods of time and sent them on their way for, I think they had to provide 4 days' provisions for people who left. And she said, Dorothy says, the coat that hangs in your closet belongs to the poor. If your brother is hungry, it is your responsibility. Let me say now that it's always hard for me to use so much sexist language. Dorothy wrote with sexist language. She was a woman of her time, and she always uses the generic man instead of human or humankind and so on. And for me, it's just really hard to keep doing. And every now and then, I can't stand it anymore, and I change what's on the page. But I feel obligated to do what's quoted here. And on the other hand, I feel obligated to do what's, in my point of view, right. So I switch all the time. Peter said, we emphasize always the necessity of smallness. The ideal, of course, would be that each Christian, conscious of duty in the lay apostolate, would take in one of the homeless as an honored guest, remembering Christ's words. The poor are more conscious of this obligation than those who are comfortably off. Now, have you ever noticed that to be true? Have you ever worked in a soup kitchen or whatever you want to call it and fed the poor and seen, or worked in the home for the homeless? I see so many of you nodding to agree with this. How well they take care of each other, how gentle most poor and homeless people are, and how kind and how generous. What is it about having things that changes us? I think that's quite often true, that during stewardship we discover sometimes the more generous people are those who have the least to give. Maybe we learned something having less, but that's Saturday's class. And so came about the notion of hospitality houses. And this went through a number of transitions. Peter liked to have little farms on the outskirts of New York. I used to like to read about this because it was sort of interesting to picture in the early 30s, maybe, what it was like to have farms in places where I know now are just apartment houses and all kinds of building. The poor come for hospitality. Who are the poor? The woman who sleeps with her husband on abandoned slum fire escapes until her baby is due. Then she comes to Dorothy. An alcoholic, released mental patient, distraught abused child, suicidal woman. All of them unmanageable, unwanted. They're sent to Dorothy. The poor are those with little to live for and less to eat, from Pittsburgh, Chicago, and right down the New York street, the seamen on strike, the children of Harlem who have never before seen a farm. No questions asked at this house, no checkout time, no charge, only kindness and the request to be fair and respectful of others, hospitality, dignity for the world's poor. Dorothy founded a home then, in the Bowery of New York. And that's a real, I'd like to go and visit it, really. That's a kind of a famous one, still exists. A fellow by the name of Mark Ellis worked with the Catholic Worker and spent time in one of those hospitality houses, spent a year doing that. He's a Jew, and I'll tell you more about him in a bit, but he did that and had a very interesting experience. Yes?
Where did their funding come from?
Well, that's a great question. Their money. It costs money to do these things. It just came, you know. Dorothy would be the first to say that they would always be running out, and then it would appear. They would receive the check they needed, or she didn't. It didn't sound to me from all the writing that I read that she did a lot of having to beat the pavement to get money from people. And, you know, that can be so often the trouble with volunteer organizations. is that they end up having to spend their whole time fundraising and can't do the work they're intended to do. There were many, many wonderful stories of gifts that just came. Now, some of them came from other parishes, other Catholic parishes, and as the hospitality houses grew across the nation, they all got a base of support from wherever they were located. They would get a check sort of miraculously from Pittsburgh into New York in those early days. And today, I believe it still operates that way, just on the gifts of people, generosity. Reminds me of Holden in some ways.
Reminds me of Mother Teresa.
Yes, very much like Mother Teresa. Dorothy said, there's always enough for one more. Everyone just take a little less. Our poverty, she said, is not a stark and dreary poverty, because we have the security which living together brings. But it is that living together that is often hard. Beds crowded together, much coming and going, people sleeping on the floor, no bathing facilities, only cold water. These are the hardships. Poverty means lack of paint. It means bed bugs, cockroaches, and rats, and the constant war against those. Poverty means body lice. Poverty means lack of soap and Lysol and cleansing powders. No one asked us to start an agency or an institution of any kind. On our responsibility, because we are our brother's keeper, if one came in hungry, there was always something in the icebox. If he needed a bed and we were crowded, there was always a quarter around to buy a bed on the Bowery. If he needed clothes, there were our friends to be appealed to, after we had taken the extra coat out of the closet first, of course. It might be someone else's coat, but that was all right, too. It is the living day-to-day, taking no thought for the morrow, seeing Christ in all who come to us, trying literally to follow the gospel that resulted in this work. What we pray for, we receive. But, of course, many times when we ask help from our fellows, we are refused. So she would sometimes really get down. She would be depressed, of course, with the pressure of it all. And you see, in the background of all the time, putting out the Catholic worker, always reaching out to as many people as possible. And that's hard work if you've ever edited a newspaper. That's a lot of work. But she had a sense of the dignity of humankind. And I love her image. Now, to me, I would have to close my eyes to see this when I read it or heard it. But picture this. One day last summer, I saw a man sitting down by one of the piers, all alone. He sat on a log, and before him was a wooden box on which he had spread out on a paper his meager supper. He sat there and ate with some pretense of human dignity. And it was one of the saddest sights I have ever seen. A poem for us to think about. We draw up our standards, measuring the worthiness of God's children, based on our values of time, utility, productivity, gratitude, and return. Dorothy disagreed. In the face and hands and even the contempt of any person, she saw the opportunity to work for God. God's standards are not like our own. We realize when we calculate the worth of people, we become poor. Now that's what happened. Oh, well, let me share one more thing first. One of the things we get kind of caught up in, or do you find this, that you start to wonder if helping somebody is benefiting them. You know, it's all the old argument about whether or not we're creating dependence or independence and so on. Valid question to ask. But sometimes we get caught up with the thing about, well, gee, they didn't thank us. I don't know if I should help those people. Will they be grateful enough? Do they use it well? Do they use their money well? Oh, my land, I hope no one ever asks that of me. Do I use my money well, indeed? And someone asked her in a newspaper interview, but won't people take advantage? And Dorothy said, Of course. And don't we take advantage of God? Cannot we put up with others? Does not God put up with us? Grace, the woman understood grace. And interesting how we have here a combination of grace in the way that she ministers to people and sees them and gives them dignity. And we also have works. There's a whole lot of works in this thing because people are just plain doing for other people all the time. And they have a sense, though, that that's what they're called to do. God is on the side of even the unworthy poor, as we know from the story Jesus told of his father and the prodigal son. And then she explains about another writer who said that, you know, we never knew when he went back what he did next. I mean, maybe after his dad gave the big party and his brother objected, maybe the prodigal went out and had a good time and blew his money again. We don't know that. We can't be sure. That wasn't the point of the story. The point was he was welcomed home. He was cared for like as he needed. And she reminds us that Jesus has another answer to that one, to forgive one's brother 70 times 7. There are always answers, she says, although they are not always calculated to soothe. Now, of course, this was an attractive opportunity for people, and many people came and wanted to volunteer at the Catholic Worker or in one of the hospitality houses, fortunately. She said, people came to join us in our wonderful work, and she put wonderful work in quotes. It all sounds very wonderful, but life itself is a haphazard, untidy, messy affair. Unless we can live simply, unquestioningly, and solitary, one might say, in the midst of a mob, then we cease to be a personalist. The more we live with people in a community, the more we must look at ourselves and regard the beam in our own eyes. Now that's part of what happened to Mark Ellis when he lived at the Catholic Worker not so terribly long ago. I don't think this book is in our bookstore, A Year at the Catholic Worker, but it reads so quickly because it's a journal. But I did put over on the table 5 of the books that are here about Dorothy Day if you're interested. Her story just is plain, entertaining in the sense of inspiring. When Mark lived at the Catholic Worker, he began to observe people. And remember I told you that he was a Jew. And this was for him then an awakening experience in some ways. Alex is in his 40s, lives a great part of his life except for occasional walks within an area of 10 square feet. At the very front of the 4th floor is Alex's home, a chair where he sits during the day and a table on top of which he sleeps during the night. About once a week he explodes, but never touches a soul. What's wrong with him? Where does he come from? All we know is that he's part of the family, which brings me back to the central focus of the meeting last night, the Gospels. Jean said that insofar as we adhere to the Gospel, we are approaching truth. That is the worker's measuring rod, the works of mercy at personal sacrifice. Community for all of creation. No turning your back on violence and sickness here, or hiring people to take care of it for you. Forgiveness at the worker is no platitude, no ideal, but a reality. St. John of the Cross said, "And where there is no love, put love, and you shall find love." Do you see what was happening to him as he observed and lived in that setting? One of the things that has been true of the hospitality houses and the Dorothy Day centers is people don't ask questions and you don't have to say you believe and you don't have to go to worship. Vespers and so on are offered and held for those people who are part of the Christian community. But Mark never had to go. He never sensed that he was required to. But obviously, he did. He was drawn in. It is strange, Mark says, when I reflect that the words of God and Jesus are heard at the worker only at Mass and at Vespers. No grace is said, and no counsel is offered. Even when you're interested in the role God plays in the volunteers' lives, there's a great reticence to discuss it. There is never a distinction drawn between who is Catholic or non-Catholic, a believer or a non-believer. The question is never raised. Here there is no speech, no definition of character, no easy answer to who God is and what God does. Sometimes you feel God emerging from and merging into the experience of service. Perhaps it's in this service that the Spirit is found. It is not, to be sure, a large and bold God, but a subtle one. Sometimes you feel a presence suffering here with you and the others. Sometimes you feel a body being broken. At other times you feel yourself surrounded by grace. Now this is a Jew is writing this. A man of the Jewish faith who began to understand something about the body broken for our sake. And I found that very inspiring, that it was the actions of these people that really counted for him. I explained, said Dorothy, that we were not a community of saints. I suppose that's part of our problem, isn't it? We all kind of think that they're all better and we aren't like them, and it's a good excuse for not getting involved because we could never do what Mother Teresa does, right? So we don't try. But Dorothy's saying these people aren't so very particularly special either. Kind of she describes them as a rather slipshod group of individuals who were trying to work out since certain principles, the chief of which was an analysis of human freedom and what it implied. We could not put people out on the street, she said, because they acted irrationally and hatefully. We were trying to overcome hatred with love, to understand the forces that made people what they are, to learn something of their backgrounds, their education, to change them, if possible, from lions into lambs. It was a practice in loving, a learning to love, a paying of the cost of love. And writing of the Catholic worker, she said that the Catholic worker was squeezed in between fascists, upset people, establishing a house for girls, doling out clothes, getting funds. Yet the newspaper grew, as I said to you earlier, from 2,500 in circulation in 1934 to 100,000 in 1937. It's still published monthly today. And you could get a copy of that. How many of you have ever worked in this kind of setting? Let me put it this way. How many of you have ever kind of wished that you could work in this kind of setting and experience it? Be honest. Yeah. It is a way of discovering ourselves and discovering a lot about people. I think a lot of us are afraid of it, though. Afraid we won't know what to say or how to behave. Sometimes I think we're afraid of danger, and that, I think, is least likely to be true. Mark will describe times at the Catholic worker when, and particularly in the Bowery, when things were upset, and they did get to the point where they wouldn't let anybody in who'd had too much alcohol. That makes a lot of sense. But on the whole, it wasn't an issue of safety. Let's think about what we learned from Dorothy overall then. Do you need to move? Are you feeling like you're falling asleep? It's awful hard at 4 in the afternoon. And what would you say of the kingdom, Dorothy? That it means peace, and so we parade for peace and go to jail, even in the 40s, because we believe in peace. Now that's what Dorothy did. She was out protesting for peace in the 40s. Now that takes a lot of courage. But she believed in peace, period. I've always respected those people. And when we give to the poor and stand with them and pray with them, for them, we have peace, even in the midst of putrid smells and crowded halls. The kingdom is not only to come, but it is to be here among us. When we glimpse Christ in the tears of humiliation, he was humiliated, and the love of giving, he gave all. In the promise of freedom, he lifted the oppressed. We do not bring the kingdom, but find it along the streets and back alleys of cities and mines. We find the kingdom as we walk the way. Peter and I feel that the work is more important than the talking or writing about the work. It has always been through the performance of the works of mercy that love is expressed. I was idly saying my rosary, which was handy in my pocket. The recitation was more or less automatic, when suddenly, like a bright light, like a joyful thought, the words of "Our Father" pierced my heart. To all those who were about me, to all the passers-by, to the longshoremen, black and white, I was akin, for we were all children of a common Father, all creatures of one Creator. And Catholic or Protestant, Jew or Christian, communist or non-communist, we were bound together by this tie. We are all brothers. Whether or not a man believes in Jesus Christ, whether or not a person believes in God, the fact remains that we are all children of one Father, Mother. The disciples didn't know our God on that weary walk to Emmaus until he sat down and ate with them. They knew him in the breaking of the bread. And how many loaves of bread are we breaking with our hungry fellows these days? Help us to do this work. Help us to know each other in the breaking of the bread. Mark Ellis finishes for us saying, "The Catholic worker has continued over the years to believe in the transforming power of love and sacrifice service. It has done so during the purges in the Soviet Union, the death camps in Nazi Germany, and the war in Vietnam. To some, perhaps even to a majority, this vision of transforming love, drawn amidst the background of hatred and violence, seems simplistic and romantic. Indeed, the world has chosen other paths to travel. For 45 years, however, the Catholic worker has offered its vision of a more human society. After having witnessed the transformation myself, I know I can never dismiss this vision of love." That would be my hope for all of us, that we would see in the least of all people that this is Christ waiting to be served, to be known, to be welcomed into our hospitable circle of love, personally and as a community. Do you have questions? She grew to be a fine woman and married, and she lived a rather normal life. Uh-huh. I've forgotten her name. It was a nice name.
I think Minneapolis has sort of a Dorothy Day by Mary Jo Copeland.
Yes, that's right. Sharing and caring hands. She's very much that type of personality. There's a difference in personalities, actually, between them. But we have that kind of thing going on. And in St. Paul, there is a Dorothy Day Center. There's one in Seattle, I think. Mm-hmm. It is kind of a wonderful thing to think of those women emerging like that. Maybe that's why they stand out. And maybe there aren't too many of us around still doing that kind of thing.
Who is this? No, that's terrible. But think of that. Maybe he allowed her to work in his printing business, yep. Which is unusual in those days.
In fact, one would have to say she had remarkable parents in some fashion.
True.
Because they both must have set her free.
Can you say something about that?
The differences between the Salvation Army and Dorothy Day hospitality houses. I would say there are many similarities, because there are many ways in which the Salvation Army is also not, it's rather unconditional, or attempts to be unconditional. But I do think it's more evangelical in its approach in trying to convert people. Now, that's my impression, but I could be wrong. Well, I think that I think we make too much of it. I don't think we can say that it's never, one never has to fear the danger of let's say the drug culture. But from what I've been able to gather and experience and observe, those things are made too much of, and that in fact there are many places where we can serve. There are many churches, and most of them are right in the middle of some city, and a lot of them are Catholic, Loaves and Fishes program, for example, where one can serve a lot of people and it just isn't a problem. Now, where it is a problem, usually there are precautions taken. So that I would not choose to use that as my first excuse for not going. One can always investigate and see if it's safe, but it probably isn't our best reason for not going. We can always go together. I'm glad you separated out mentally ill, too. We have so much more of that now. It appears that we have so much more, so many more mentally ill people who are now becoming homeless people. And the whole term mental illness is so misunderstood and has less to do with what we would perceive to be violence and craziness and has so much more to do with depression and other forms of mental illness. And these are people who just plain need to be cared for. I respect what you're doing.
It's been taught.
Are you speaking of mental retardation?
Yes.
That would be another thing. That would be another area. That would be a learning capacity, and that would be different from mental illness, which would have to do usually with depression.
Drug abuse, too.
And drug abuse, that's still another category, yeah. We have all these kinds of...
Because when I... We lived in Columbus, Ohio. We used to go to a ward for mentally ill women to entertain them once a month. And sometimes you'd come out there and talk to people that were in there, and they were just as smart as you and I.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a teacher from New York City that was in there. And you never once saw her that she acted differently. But there was no family to release her to sign for the papers, so there she was.
Mm. Mm.
And so I think we created a lot of problems.
Institutional things can be so difficult. And we don't want to minimize, as you have said, Barb, we don't want to minimize the difficulty of the kind of work that Dorothy is doing and did and encouraging. And she says that, you know, this is no great thing. It doesn't feel so great all the time to be doing this. But we do it together, and that helps, because when I'm weary, then you can take over for a while. And that does get us through. And in fact, that inspires us. Well, who knows? Maybe someday you'll be moved to do something. Maybe this is just one of the seeds that'll be planted for you to move in a new direction. That would be my hope. The kingdom is here. Are there any Lutheran possibilities?
What? The Washington, D.C. area, especially?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think there's a nationally organized Lutheran way of dealing with this sort of issue, but I think in different communities. Yeah, Lutheran Social Service. Part of it comes from the fact that Lutherans are tend to be middle-class people. And you hear what Dorothy's talking about. She's talking about the poor from the start, from the time she was a young girl, even though she wasn't part of that group. She's talking about, quote, the workers, unquote. The Catholic tradition has always been to deal more with that particular economic group. So Lutherans have established a long-standing tradition of doing this kind of ministry, and we're not used to it. And we're such theologians, you know. Everyone gives us a lot of credit for being the thinkers. It's great. And we have something to contribute, but then we don't want to hide in our ivory tower either. It's a good question whether or not Lutherans are doing something. Well, you're Lutherans. Most of you can do what you want. Someone's waiting. You know, in some ways, I think, someone's just waiting for you to say, let's do this. I don't think it would be hard for people to rally help in starting such projects. I think there are tons of people out in our congregations who want to do it. I can remember my fourth grader saying, we were talking about offerings and stuff, and he said, well, I thought it all went to the poor. He was so disappointed to find it out that it went for the heat. And, you know, and the real stuff, and the Sunday school materials. He was the one who was going to drop out of, he said, when I get to seventh grade, I'm dropping out of church. And I said, that's when confirmation starts. Oh. But you see, if he had felt more a part, and in fact, there were a lot of projects that the youngsters did eventually do that made them part of service, part of sacrifice, which we said at the beginning is really something we need to develop. And I agree with you. What we're afraid of is if we meet somebody poor, it'll tell us we ought not be so rich. Mm-hmm. When we're with somebody who's really in despair, it takes a little edge off of all our glitz. And that's hard to come to terms with, and so it's easier to avoid it. But you won't do that, because in the name of Christ, you've been sent to do otherwise. Go in peace. Serve the Lord.